everyone, to Skid Row Chatter with your host, Tom Pitts. I'm Pam Stack, your tech for tonight. I'll be answering the phones. So take down this number so that you'll be ready when we take callers. The number is 347-633-9609. Tom Pitts is the author of Hustle, Piggyback, and Knuckleball, which was the Authors on the Air 2015 Novella of the Year. He's the acquisitions editor at Gutter Books and the host of Skid Row Chatter here in the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tom Pitts, take it away. Hi, Tom.
Thank you very much. Glad to be back back in the saddle on the airwaves. And today we're going to talk to two authors on Skid Row, both Josh Stallings and Steve Lawton. And I'm going to chat with Steve first, and then we're going to chat with Josh, and hopefully we can squeeze a couple calls in while we have a little round table towards the end. But let me tell you a little bit about them both. Josh Stallings is the massively dyslexic award-winning author of the Moses McGuire hard-boiled crime novels, the Anthony Award-nominated he also penned the Anthony Award-nominated memoir, All the Wild Children, which is a gut-ripping, white-knuckling read. And the Glitter Rock Disco Heist novel, Young Americas, which is out, available now, and there's plenty of buzz happening about that. He was raised by hippie activists in the mountains above Palo Alto, and he now happily resides, not everybody has that claim, happily residing in Los Angeles with his wife, two dogs, and a cat named Riddle. Steve, all-around nice guy and awesome cat, Steve, is a writer living in Los Angeles. His short fiction has been published by Out of the Gutter, Criminal Element, Dark Corners, I'm sorry, my computer's going down, and I don't have it memorized, Steve, although I probably should. I just lost the page. Let me finish your bio before you chime in and start singing your own accolade.
Make some stuff up. It's interesting.
I'll make stuff up off the top of my head. I can say Weird Books, Belt Fiction, Shotgun Honey, and Crime Spree Magazine, and his debut novel, which I blurbed, which is fabulous, Bad Citizen Corporation, was published by Rare Bird Books in November 2015. And he's got a new one coming out, a novella called Crosswise with Down and Out, my new favorite publisher. Welcome both of you to the show. How are you doing tonight?
Fantastic.
Fantastic. And Josh, you're going to be hanging in for the first 10 minutes or so while we vent.
I'm going to listen to you, yes. I am. I'm going to listen.
Feel free to fact check and chime in if I start, you know, misquoting Sarah Palin or anything like that. So Steve, so you're still doing the big push for a Bad Citizen Corporation. You want to tell us something about that book?
It's kind of the shorthand for it is punk rock noir. It's about a former sort of underground punk rock lead singer of a band called Bad Citizen Corporation, and they're sort of known regionally when he's in his 20s. And then now he's in his late 30s going on 40, and he's been a police officer for 10 years. And so a lot of the novel's about the sort of juxtaposition of those two sort of very different parts of his life. And where the book kicks off, he's just shot a kid in the line of duty and loses his badge, and things really spiral out of control for him at that point, and sort of makes him really take a look at what's going on in his life, and makes him make some decisions about how he's going to move forward with music and whether or not he's going to continue to be a police officer.
There's a feel to the book and an air that just sort of puts you in mind of Southern California. And I've noticed with the reviews and the blurbs and what other people have said about the book, that seems to be a common denominator. There seems to be a feeling of, you know, like longboards and sidewalks and palm trees. And for whatever reason, you just seem to have really crystallized that Los Angeles, especially that late 80s punk rock Los Angeles feeling, even though those parts are sort of like not a flashback, but it's the character's history. It's not it's written in current time. How much of that is you? I know you played in bands and stuff like that. How much did you feel like you were a part of the book as far as a part of the main character?
Yeah, I wanted to sort of write about, I grew up along the beach in Southern California in the 80s, And so, you know, growing up in that area, you sort of lived in the shadow of Black Flag and Descendants and Minutemen and all those great SST bands that were coming out at the time. And there was this sort of very blue-collar vibe about the beach. It sort of still had, you know, pirate sort of waterfront culture that was shot through with a little danger. And they were pretty exciting times to grow up in down there. And, you know, obviously over the course of time, Southern California beaches have become less a place for blue-collar people, and they've become much more money. I mean, you can say for better or worse, you know. I mean, if you own a house along the beach, then you want the property value to keep going up, and you don't want tattooed dudes on skateboards, you know, drinking beer in your front yard. But I kind of wanted to write about that, and I didn't really know how to write about it. And then I hit on this idea of tapping into my musical background and getting Greg Salem, a former punk singer who's a cop, so that it felt like he could describe the sort of dissonance that's happening between the old days and the new days. And so that sort of was the genesis of how the story came to be.
Well, it definitely it works on a couple levels, because there's not only – I mean, the gentrification thing is a timely subject, and it's timely everywhere. You know, I was up in Reno a couple months ago, and one of the roughest streets in downtown Reno is full of bistros and cafes and you know, framing shops and all this stuff. And if it's happening in Reno, goddammit, it's happening everywhere. But it not only works as far as his commentary on it, his life experience is a metaphor for sort of having to deal with the reality of growing up and putting away childish things, you know?
Oh, for sure. And that is something, you know, to your previous question, is something that I definitely experienced personally. While I didn't stay like a pure blood punk rocker my whole life, you know, I kind of went off and started playing pop music and power pop and all this different stuff. And punk rock was always there foundationally. But even that, you know, you get into your 30s and you're in a van, you know, at 6 o'clock at night in Buffalo and you're freezing your ass off and you're going like, wait, why am I still doing this? And you have to kind of question what your motivations are, and if you're really just continuing to pursue dreams that are really old, and maybe it's time to move on, and maybe it's time to not. And then on the flip side of that, my own personal experience and the experience of Greg as he continues to progress is, you know, finding a way to play music as an adult that's not all about the, like, big dream of being an international rock star, but just doing it because you love it. And so that's sort of what he's sifting through as well.
Well, it's funny. I will admit to this. You know, I've been in bands and I did the independent label thing and all that stuff in the 80s. And, you know, when I hit my 40s, I looked at some of my peers who were still going at it and still clung to the dream. And I was like, you know, who wants to be cruising around in a sticky van when you're 4 years old playing for beer and, you know, getting shitty pay and driving through the night with no roadie? And then, you know, now I'm pushing up against 50, and by the way, pushing back. I think to myself, you know, I see guys who are still doing the same thing, but the coin has flipped once again. I'm like, you lucky bastards. You're still out there, responsibility-free, and you're still able to – and you're right. It's not so much about – it's about sort of accepting not defeat, but it's accepting that the dream is not going to happen and doing it just for the love of the music and for the love of what you do. And God bless those guys who can still stand being out there in the vans cruising around in their 50s. Personally, I don't think I could physically take it at this age. But I'm amazed at some of the guys that – who would have thought in, like, 1987 that, you know – 30 years down the line, 35 years down the line, there's going to be a market for their T-shirts and demos. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of that's down to digital music distribution. It's like when you put on a Pandora station or something like that and you get a mix of music back at you, it doesn't give you any disclaimer of when the music was made. It's based on an algorithm that these songs are alike. So I think people are actually rediscovering a lot of old music that they otherwise wouldn't have discovered. So I think it's created a secondary market for people to to be able to go out and continue to do what they do. And I'm with you, like, more power to you. Like, the guys that I know that still do that with intent, and they do it as a living and as a lifestyle, which I guess that's probably the most important part, is it's a lifestyle. They're not doing it because they don't know what else to do. They're doing it because that's what they do. This is what their life has always been about, and they love it. And I I'm like you, where occasionally I'll kick myself and go like, wait, why did I walk away from that? And it's romantic from a distance, perhaps a little bit. But I wanted to channel some of that conversation I have with myself into the book, and that's sort of like how I shaped the character of Greg Sullivan.
You know, it's interesting. I was thinking when you were talking about the beach scene, the whole punk scene down there. I remember being young and like 16 years old and still in Canada, and reading some article about how on Huntington Beach the punks would walk up to you with little tiny knives and stab you just in the fat of your belly, just a little tiny quarter inch cut. And Huntington Beach specifically had such a bad reputation. And then, you know, a year and a half later, when I was, you know, playing and touring and being in all these spots, it really didn't have the same, you know, I was like, wow, that was a powerful piece of journalism to spook me across an entire nation. But it really wasn't like that up close and personal. But I was glad to have been part of it.
Yeah, there were definitely punk gangs roaming around in L.A. in the 80s. There was no doubt about that, like the Suicidal Tendencies people and like those kinds of people. And you would go to shows and you had to be worried about some of the skinhead gangs that were waiting out front, you know, chomping on speed and just waiting to kick your ass, or, you know, ganging up on you in the slam pit and that kind of thing. Like, that kind of stuff definitely did happen, but I don't think that was the majority of what was going on. I mean, it was just kids kind of getting off on the adrenaline of the music and the sort of underground culture that was attached to it.
So there's a character in your book, the guy that got kicked out of the band, the guy that's got the drug problem, the guy that couldn't mature, the guy mired in the past, even though he's not even in the band anymore. And he kind of represents that darker side and the inability to move on. What's his name again? What's that guy's name?
Marco?
Yeah, and he's still got, you know, and he ended up playing a pretty important role in unraveling the mystery by having his ear to the ground and still being rooted in the dark side and with the bad people and stuff. And I felt like that was an important sort of the other side of the coin, you know, for what Greg is experiencing and going through. It was important to see sort of, yeah, what the rest of the story was. Was that an intentional move on your part?
Well, you know, what's really funny is Marco wasn't in like probably the first four or five drafts. I sent one of the drafts off to a beta reader, and it's a person who knows me very well, and he was like, you know, part of your personality is you're pretty funny, you're pretty quick with one-liners, and I don't see any of that in this book. Like, I get the darkness, and I get all that, but where's that part of your personality that's like the quick one-liners and that kind of thing? And so I thought about it, and I was a drummer. And definitely prone to some cliches in my drumming days. I never got really as extreme as Marco, but, you know, I tapped into that sort of part of my past and wrote the character into the script. And then, like, he kind of just took on a life of his own and really became Greg's sidekick, to the point where a lot of reviews call him out as people's favorite character. Which is, you know, it's interesting what we do when we write these stories, right? Because I was going to write about this guy, Greg Salem, and there are people out there who are responding to Marco in a much more visceral way, to the point at which I just handed in the first draft of the second Greg Salem book to my editor on Monday, and Marco plays a huge role in it, you know? So he's just, you know, it's a lucky accident that I got good feedback and that I was able to tap into that part of my personality. I'm really happy that character exists.
Well, I don't want to get all spoilery about what the future holds for the main character, but the undercurrent, or I don't know if it's really the background or the backbone rather, but what's always under the surface is this terrible shooting he is involved in, you know, and which, you know, at the time you probably thought, well, that's certainly ripped from today's headlines. And in the time that you wrote it since it's come out, and just it seems week by week there seems to be more and more news. There was just an atrocity up in about six blocks from my house here in San Francisco. The police shootings keep on happening. Is the next book involving the fallout from that?
Without being too giving away too much, I had envisioned the whole three book arc of the story before I sat down to write book one. So there are a couple of overarching stories that go through all three books, but it was always intended to be a trilogy. You know, to the point at which my wife was like, you know, why didn't you just write the whole book at once? And I was like, no one wants a 1,200 page mystery novel about some punk rock dude, you know. So I broke it up into three books, but there's mysteries. right. Yeah, but there's individual mysteries in every book, but there are a couple of overarching mysteries that pay off at the end of the third book. And I had that all planned out when I sat down to write word one.
Well, I was looking at your trajectory and how things have been going, and I told this slipped my radar. I mean, it's not out yet, but this it slipped by me. I didn't realize that you had another completely separate release coming out with Down and Out Books. Now, in this book, Crosswise, is it a novella?
It is a novella, yes.
For someone who seemed to paint the entire sort of Southern California scene so successfully, you moved this one's in Florida, right?
Yeah, there's kind of an interesting story. I was on vacation in Florida, in a little town in the Panhandle, sort of in the Panama Beach, Destin area. It's where this town's called Seaside. It's where they shot the Truman Show. So, you know, lots of clapboard houses with brightly colored paint, right? And I was just kind of walking around, and I'd get up in the morning before everybody else woke up and just started writing a short story. And I came in at about 5,000 words when I was down there. And I know this town pretty well because I've been there a few times. And I got to about 5,000 words, and I thought I had this really interesting short story. And I sent it to a publisher, and I said, do you think that there's a novel or novella here? And the publisher was like, yeah, absolutely, definitely a novella. So I started writing it out, and my relationship with that novella, that publisher didn't really work out. But through my editor, Elaine Ash, she read it and really dug it and was very supportive of me publishing it as a standalone. And she introduced me to Eric Campbell at Down and Out Books. And I've been thrilled to work with him. And I've been thrilled because, like, Rare Bird Books and who Tyson Cornell is because of his music background and the kind of music-themed and darker literary fiction that he publishes was exactly the right home for Greg Salem for all three of those books. But Down and Out is much more of, like, a straight-up crime novel or novella. And I think that Down and Out's the perfect place for that book. So I've been really lucky to find right publisher for my book so far.
Well, I'm proud to say that we'll be press mates because Down and Out, Eric Campbell is awesome, and he has agreed to re-release my novel Hustle, which I'm very excited to have out with Down and Out. They got a killer roster, and now we can be elbowing each other there on their webpage. So that is awesome. They're an up and comer.
Oh, congrats, man! That's fantastic, dude. Good for you. Hustle's a great book, and I'm glad it's going to get another shot at getting people to look at it. That's awesome.
I hope so, yeah. And Eric's an awesome cat, and he was enthusiastic about it and did the deal on Handshake at OutreCon. He just seems like a solid cat, and I'm looking forward to it. We'll see what it should be out in a couple months. We'll do, you know, an official announcement. Nobody's listening now, right? So we'll make an official announcement out there on the interweb sometime in the near future.
Yeah. And
do that. Well, as a segue, speaking of trilogies, Josh, are you still conscious? Are you still with us?
I am so with you.
Yes.
Tune in.
You are the author of the Moses McGuire series. Three right now, right?
Yeah, I from what I can see, that's all there'll be of it, but I'm not sure. I mean, he's pretty beat up by the end of those three.
Well, you know, when I first talked to you about, you know, when I first met you, we spent some time chatting about the game, the business, and all that kind of stuff. And I believe I was still scrambling for a publisher for Hustle and worried about, you know, what kind of house, a big enough house, too small a press, you know, all that kind of stuff. And you told me how much success and how satisfied you were to have, even though you had already had the Anthony nomination for All the Wild Children with Snub Nose, you're like, you know what? The Moses McGuire series I did on my own, and I make more money at it. I'm happy with it. I have more control. And it's what you felt at the time was the best move and the greatest success for you. Do you still feel that way?
Yeah. No, it's until it get, the Moses books have sold really well. I've gotten awards off the stuff I'm writing. It's the only thing I can't break is things like Mystery Writers of America haven't yet let indie writers in, even when we outsell normal traditional writers. But that's a hard one to sort of crack. Traditional newspapers don't review my books. So there's a few places it's hard to crack. The next year for me, frankly, is about trying to break bigger into, because the only thing, indie presses for me are great. I love Eric, by the way. Eric Campbell's an awesome, awesome man. There's people doing great things. But because I've already built a career that's very indie, unless I can find a publisher that brings a bigger thing to it, can get me into big stores, can get me reviewed by the New York Times, it's almost financially is better for me to do it myself. It just makes more sense. And I really come to this place that we as writers have to stop. Don't think with ego. Think when we're selling books, that's business. Writing is art. Selling books is business. So I just look, where is the most money? Where can I make the best deal, get my books in the most amount of hands? And it's not about ego for me. It used to be about, I wanted to have a publisher so I could say they liked me, they really liked me. But I don't give a fuck anymore who likes me. I don't know what happened. Something broke and I just don't care. And so I just signed with Amy Moore Benson, who I love as an agent, just fucking love her. And we're going to see, with her, I'm going to see if we can go bigger. I've never had an agent up until now. It's all but me. So we've got some ideas on trying to get into the next level with the writing.
That's awesome. And she's Canadian.
What's that?
And she's Canadian.
Yeah, which makes her uber cool. And if Trump wins, I'm hoping that I can start the Underground Railroad going into Canada and we'll end up at her house. Because I'm getting out of this motherfucker, I got to be honest.
Well, I don't pack your bags just yet. I don't think you've got a lot to worry about. But who knows?
Who knows? Weirder shit has happened. Gorbachev said he wouldn't cast Reagan in a movie playing the president because he said, who would believe him? He later became the president. That's the fucking truth.
Yeah, hindsight isn't always 20/20. So let's talk about the book you're pushing at the moment, Young Americans.
Yeah.
Which is, it's uncanny because, you know, on the approach to this interview, of course, David Bowie passed. And it's been maybe a few months since I read the book, but that whole sort of feel in my own memories of what my perception of what, you know, the big kids were doing when I was young in the 70s and what I thought, you know, was going on at discos and in Los Angeles while I was just out on the farm in Canada, it now sort of fused with your book for some reason. The memories get confused. You want to tell us a little bit about the premise of what's going on in the Young Americans?
Yeah, Young Americans, well, the truth is it is a real world that I grew up in. I was a glitter rock kid. And the world is real. It's just that what I sat in there was I came out of the last Moses book and out of the memoir so beaten the fuck up, I wanted to write something light. And this idea came to me. All I knew was I wanted to write a glitter heist novel. And I thought, what the fuck does that mean? And a disco heist. I'm like, okay. And so that's where it started. And what it's about is it's a group of young people who are, some of them are ex-criminals, and they're forced into doing a last crime, and they're doing a heist on a gay disco on New Year's Eve 1976 in San Francisco, and craziness ensues. So it's about that, but it's also about all those characters falling in love and discovering. It's like, I think it's more about that last moment before you have to grow the fuck up. It's that last, it has the feeling of that last summer before things get serious, and by the end of the book, things do get serious. It's like that
it's
moment
like American,
when you transition.
It's like a noir American Graffiti.
Hey, that's true, yes, actually.
I know, you should have called me for the blurb. There you go.
Fuck, yes. My era.
Yeah, well, you do a beautiful, like, right from the beginning, you know, it starts out with your female protagonist up in Humboldt County, stripping for loggers up, you know, way up to 101. And, you know, that setting and you captured with that seemed to, you know, I knew I was in for getting enveloped in the story and getting enveloped in, because it's so accurate, just some of the small details about that whole Northern California thing. And then you end up in San Francisco and doing some, you know, I always do this when I read books. I end up doing some Google mapping and researching and, you know, clipping names and finding out what's fictional, what's not. And I just really enjoyed the whole setting, especially having been in San Francisco since the 80s and on the tail end of the glory days of the big discos and that whole sort of explosion in the 70s. It was just a well laid out thing. And you're right, the character growth is a big part of the story. It's not simply a crime story. It's what's going on with the team as individuals.
Yeah, isn't that? That's what I think we do, right? I mean, for me, that's why I loved Raymond Chandler. She never gave a fuck about plots. He cared about what happened with characters. And plots matter a lot in a heist novel, but I always keep my eye on what I care about is what happens to characters, because that's why I read. I don't read to find out about blood splattering against the wall or anything. I think I read crime because it puts people in heightened situations, but really it's to learn about characters, to meet new people. You know?
You hear that again and again, and it was tough for me to accept, but for me to sort of come to realize how important that is. You know, it sounded very trite coming from agents and publishers, and you know, I need characters I can care about. I need someone to care about. But you know, James Lieberg, who, if I may, a plug, I'm interviewing on this show next February 17th, has a great quote, which I'll squeeze out of him, about giving. And it's something he was told as a young writer, that you just had to give the audience somebody they cared about. The rest of the story took care of themselves if they just gave a shit in a heartfelt way about the main character. And that means connecting with. And I think that's what you successfully succeed. That's what you succeed with in Young Americans.
There's something else in there, is that there's a mistake. Like 80s action films, if you ever watch them, always start with a guy doing some good act. So you know he's a good guy. You know, he saves a kitten or some bullshit. And I never bought that because I didn't grow up with nice guys like that. I grew up with some fucked up people. So I used to think they meant I have to write nice people who do good things. And I thought, fuck, I don't know. I don't know those people, A, and I'm uninterested in them, B. Well, James Lee Burke doesn't either. I mean, he writes about drunks, and his new book is about a guy who has, you know, rage blackouts and beats people. But it's that we care about them. And I know if I care about them, somebody else out there will too. So I don't know how to write a big book for the masses, but I know how to write a book for me that I'll care about the characters. And I figure if I do, somebody else will too.
There you go.
So it's not about being like really nice people, you know, fuck them.
Very true. We're at the bottom of the hour. So I'm going to let Pam do her a very official sounding station break and station identification. And we'll try to see if we can squeeze in some calls and carry on after the break.
Thank you, Tom, and thank you, Steve and Josh. This is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. We're on Skid Row Chatter with host Tom Pitts. His guests are Josh Stalling and Steve Loudon. If you want to call in, the microphones are and the phone lines are now open. The number is 347-633-9609. And if you're on Facebook, you can look at Skid Row Chatter with host Tom Pitts. You'll see that I am posting there parts of the conversation too. And yes, it's true, James Lee Burke is coming on February 17. Back to you, Tom.
Thank you very much, Ben. Captain. You know, we talked to Steve about what's coming up with Crosswise and his sequel for BCC. What's next on the plate for you, Josh?
The very next thing coming out is a short story I'm real happy with. That's in, I'm trying to think what the name of the book is. I can't remember anyway. It's a replacement. It's a book of replacement songs turned into stories.
What a coincidence. That's a Gutter book anthology.
Yeah. Is that
with our new Yep.
I didn't
know.
I just know Jay Stringer asked me to do it, so I wrote a piece based on the ledge that I'm really fucking proud of.
Gutter did real well. So we've been trying to follow up with a few more rock and roll ones, and I'm really glad to hear you're on board with the Replacements one, because they're, you know, one of my favorite bands from life.
Yeah, and it's something has broken free in the last two short stories I've written that informed the, it's like they're both set in the world of my new novel, which is about an LAPD detective, and it's about a year out, but it deals with mental illness and how we deal with mentally challenged adults and a lot of that stuff. My older boy is developmentally disabled, so it's stuff that I care about, and I've had cops try and draw down on him. So it's stuff that I want to write about. But these short stories I've written, this and there's one in The Last Protectors too, that kind of deal with the world I'm starting to move into. And something broke free, and I'm writing different.
And hey, by the way, before I ask this next question, I want to congratulate you on the Lefty. You got a Lefty nomination coming up for the Left Coast.
How fucking weird is this?
You know, you're gonna have to buy a trophy shelf.
We're there up against Crass and Conley. I mean, these are really fucking big time writers and big publishers. And I'm going, really? Okay.
Well, hopefully you can level the playing field for all of us. Good luck with it. But, you know, you mentioned just a minute ago being a dad, and I know Steve is a father, too. And I was chiding Joe Clifford earlier this week about his father responsibilities and riding with a toddler in his arms. Well, not a toddler. Well, not an infant either. With a baby.
Yeah.
Sorry. But what's how do you your kids are older. Steve's kid. How old are your kids, Steve?
6 and 10.
So how do you both find time to squeeze in the writing, still keep, you know, the bills paid? Because that's something that I'm always challenged with. Steve, let's start with you. Where do you work it in? You get up at 5 a.m. Do you lock the kids out of the room? What happens?
A little bit of all of that. I definitely, as I got deeper and deeper into it, you know, 5 years ago, it was just like, I want to write a book. And I just kind of started doing it when I had free time. And then as I got deeper into it, I had to start scheduling stuff. And I definitely do wake up at 5 o'clock and write for a couple hours before work when I'm in the heat of it. And then after they go to bed at night, I'll forego any other kind of entertainment or interaction with my wife and go write again. But I've also gotten really good at – I can drop in. I don't have to, like, limber up or be in the right mood. Like, if I've got, like, 11 minutes before we're going to go somewhere, I can drop down into a chair and write a couple paragraphs. And I leave extensive notes for myself at the end of every page. Wherever I stop, I leave 5 or 6 bullets where my stream of consciousness was going, so that when I sit down again, I know where I was. And that's just, like, multitasking time management stuff, but it seems to work for me.
If I'm in the middle of a novel and I know what's happening next, or I do what you said, I leave a sentence to remind me what was about to happen. If I'm in the midst, I can sit down and drop in. The problem is when I let go for a few days and I let life get in the way, then I've got to backtrack, and that's what always kind of kills me and slows me down, and it's a constant battle. But I do agree that when you're in the midst, it's easier, actually, oddly enough, to make time. But it's when you've lost. It's like exercise, I guess. When you know if you miss out on exercise, it's harder to get back on that treadmill, so to speak. Josh, how about you? How have you found yourself crafting the time over the years?
What Steve said is really true for me is that I used to think there was something called a muse and also the bullshit because I was an artist for a dad, and what I learned was, the muse only came to me if I set my ass on a seat and put a keyboard in front of me. So as long as I was willing to do that every day, I actually got some shit done. And it's for me, and I slip in and out of this. Don't ever think I'm good at it, but it's about discipline. If I sit down to write, even if it's 20 minutes a day, and say I'm going to write every day, then I stay in the flow. And I'm like you, if I drift out for 2 weeks, I'm fucked. I'm like, where was I? I start from fresh then, you know. But when I do it every day, which is really once I'm into a novel, I do, then I just set out a little bit of time. When I started writing, I wrote in a broom closet, a teeny little closet, set a desk and a typewriter because my kids, it had a door, so I'd close the door and they knew Daddy was working. Because I was just sitting on the couch daydreaming about a novel, they would come over and sit on my lap and my wife would say, if you're just sitting there, could you take care of this and this and this? I'm like, I'm working. She goes, how the fuck do I know you're working? You're just sitting there. So I just carved out this little closet to sit in so they knew I was working. If Dad was in there, he was working. And yeah,
I just want to clarify.
I've done all my life.
I just want to clarify. Did you say you were working in the closet?
Yes, I was working in the closet. I was in, but I'm out of the closet now. I'm comfortable with it, okay?
No, hey, I just.
Well, hey,
2016. Me personally, hey, listen, I'm telling you, I have a bathroom in the back of our house that's pretty much defunct with a broken shower that's stacked full of boxes, and I sit literally on the shitter. That is my chair with my little TV table in front of me. But, I mean, that is the key to having a door you can close and being shut off to let your mind roam, so to speak. But it's a small, confined, messy, crowded space, not unlike my mind. I think that part of it is important. I've never understood the concept of being in a cafe. maybe that's more for the poets. I don't know.
I've had to write in a cafe. The first Moses book, because I was working on the West Side, so I was driving a lot. At lunches, I'd go to cafes and write, and I could do it there. But I think a door is our most valuable tool we got, is to be able to close a fucking door so I can be alone with my thoughts and think things and nobody's looking over my shoulder.
Well, yeah, there's that. You can scratch your belly and no one's looking. Stephen King once said he's big on the door thing. You got to have a door you can close. I don't know how he said it, but that was the essential concept. And he talked about, you know, in his Carrie days and his other really early books, they were living in a trailer, and he wrote in the laundry room of the trailer. It must have been a big trailer if they had a laundry room in it, but he was in a trailer, and he wrote on the ironing board. That was his desk. And when I read that, I was like, you know what? I don't really need no more excuses. I can't, you know, if he can swing the start of his career on a ironing board, then goddamn it, I can work with a TV tray in front of a toilet. So there you go.
Josh, I liked what you said about staring off in space, though, because like when you talk about writing, what I've come to really realize about like what my process is. A lot of my writing doesn't really happen in front of the keyboard. It happens in me noodling about what my characters will do or pondering which direction the story could go and like, you know, going on a mountain bike ride or something like that. I'll work out so many plot points and beats in the story. And I count that as writing time as well, right? Because that way when I do sit down, I kind of already know what I'm going to be doing because I'm not a plotter. Right? I don't plot out my story. I kind of just write from forward. So,
well, see, when the light bulb goes on and you're out on the bicycle, do you have to? Are you able to retain that, or do you got to pull right over it, then pull out the phone and text it to yourself? Which is actually what I often do. But I mean, are you afraid of those like disappear, like steam out of your ears, or do you have to stop and call yourself and make a note?
I do all those things. I'll text myself. I'll put a note on my phone. I'll leave myself a voicemail. I'll email myself. Like if I just kind of put that research bucket, like, you know, maybe Greg should do this, there should be a character named Marco, or whatever it is, will happen when I'm out and about, and I just respond by jotting it down more in a digital sense these days than actually physically writing paper, but definitely try to capture it when I have an idea that I like.
Well, good, because I feel often like I'm the only one with a massive Swiss cheese size hole in my brain from massive drug abuse. So I think, you know, other writers, they probably just think about this and they get back and they remember what the hell they're doing. And I got to scratch it down wherever I can, or I will forget. And then I'll often forget where I put the note anyway. But which reminds me, I do want to touch base on this because the show is called Skid Row Chatter. You know, I will bet dollars to donuts that I'm the only one having a beer right now. And the only reason I'm doing it, because I know Rob Pierce is probably listening, and I hate to disappoint him. But neither of you guys drink, correct?
Now. Can I say now?
And Josh, your history has been well documented all the while.
Mine is epic.
Yeah, it is epic. And if you want to learn more about the darkness that is Josh Sterling's, I highly suggest you pick up All the Wild Children. It's a jaw dropper. And Steve, I know a little bit of your about your history. You know, you weren't always a sober guy. How does that play in? No, capital no. How does that play into your to your writing, to your stories? You know, drawing on the past. You have. You know, is there a contradiction within you with writing about characters who are you know, twisted, drug abusing, you know, madmen in some cases, and how do you reconcile that?
Well, I mean, you know, in Bad Citizen Corporation, Greg Salem is sober, or he's trying to be. He's been in some kind of program or other on and off for years, and then his psychic Marco is just blatantly a drug abusing lunatic.
One of my favorite scenes in that book, by the way, the AA meeting when they're out on the surfboards in the water.
That's
awesome.
Fucking awesome.
Great scene. That was brilliant. Really enjoyed that. But I'm sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Oh no! I'm glad you enjoyed it. That was one of those. That was on the mountain bike moment. Like, I know where I can put the meeting. I feel lucky in that. Like, I can write from a place of pretty good confidence about what it's like to be wasted and what it's like to be sober. So when I'm writing about the stuff that Marco's doing or any of the other characters, and you know, there's quite a lot of drug use in Crosswise that's coming out from Down and Out Books. I'm writing, you know, about things that I understood in the past, but I still understand them. You know, you've done some of these drugs or you've drank to excess before. You still know what that physically feels like. It's like a muscle memory. And so I can write about that pretty confidently, but I can also write about the struggles of what it's like to try to stay sober. And whether you do that through a program or you go cold turkey, that's a struggle within itself. And so I don't feel conflicted at all about it. Especially at this point, I've been sober more than 8 years. So it's not really fresh for me. It's just another part of my life.
Was that something had? Go ahead.
No, I wanted to say that I think all of us came from fucked up places, yourself included, Tom. And if we wrote books about where we are now, they'd be like literary boring novels about professors somewhere. So we're all digging into our past to write about shit we aren't doing anymore, because we don't write about characters who are evolved to where we are now, or they'd be pretty dull. That's my thought.
Well, I wonder, and this is for each of you, but see if you could add first. Was the seed of your writing career, did it start before you put down the bottle, or did that stuff have to stop before you could even get the clarity? And for me, certainly, the discipline, which is the bigger bigger thing to tackle, I think, when writing, did that all have to stop before you could begin in earnest writing?
Just to be really clear, I didn't put down the bottle. The bottle got put down on me really hard, to the point where it squashed me. So let's just be clear about that. I actually wrote a novel in 2001, 2002. And enough, Josh, I wrote it in a closet in my living room in an apartment. And I would just go in this closet and write every day. And it capped out at about 120,000 words. And it's just psychotic. Very much a trunk novel. Kind of always had the discipline to do it, but I don't know that I was going to write anything publishable, whether that was, you know, self-publishing or publishing with an indie press or going for a big five or whatever it is. That I was this book that I wrote back then, it was just me ranting, really. It was 120,000 words of me ranting, and it was psychotic. And so I don't think I had the discipline to actually be careful and considerate about writing until after I got some clarity in my life. So I guess a little bit of both.
Do you say careful and considerate? Are you referring to the reader, yourself, or the art?
With the characters and sort of the plot development and the character development, like, to really think it through.
Yeah, to present something that is palatable. Do you ever feel like you want to go back to that 120,000 word behemoth and peel away the skin of the onion and see if there's some vegetable there or just some rotten onion? Do you feel, or is that something that's just that was an exercise that demon you've worked out of your system?
Well, interestingly, prior to sitting down to write Bad Citizen Corporation, which was about 5 years ago, the year before that, I pulled that thing off and dusted it off and sent it to an editor and a couple of people and said, is there anything here? And they read it and they gave me really strong feedback and said it was probably more publishable than I thought. But I should tell you that what this book is a reimagination of the history of American rock and roll in the 20th century pulled through the eyes of a circus clown.
I want it now.
Yeah, so it might rear its ugly head again, but it was like a lot of it was me channeling my frustrations about the music industry, quite honestly, and what I was writing about at the time doesn't exist anymore. It probably wouldn't make any sense to anybody in 2016. So is there something there? You know, potentially, but I think for now it's going to – I'm pretty convinced it's going to stay a Trunks novel.
Okay. How about how about you, Josh?
It's my workaholism has always superseded my alcohol and drug addiction. So I wrote a lot when I was drinking, but I would drink a fuck of a lot. And I wrote mostly screenplays back then. I did script doctor work. I did a lot of that. And when I got sober, I had to be willing to give up writing because I didn't know if I could. And a friend of mine, I said, what if I get rid of my demons? And he started laughing, going, you think you can get rid of your demons? And, you know, like, really? And so it took me a little 6 months, a little more sober before I started actually trying to write again. And what I discovered is it had all the passion and all the noise of my early writing, but it had something else. There's some kind of, I don't structure, I don't know how to do a lot of those things, but what it had was some, like, what was raw in me was able to come out cleaner. It wasn't as filtered by other writers I was pretending to be.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
my voice came through. Yeah, so I think sober, I write cleaner. As odd as that is.
Well, I think it's important to exercise your demons. But what I found that I just have really in shape demons from all that exercise.
Oh fuck yeah, me too. They are doing push-ups every day.
Active and ready to kick my ass. Well, that's something that I think absolutely comes through when you do find a little more clarity as you're able to let go of, and that's a certain amount of pretense, I guess, when you want so badly to emulate someone, you end up not plagiarizing, but just sort of copying, you know, taking on too much of someone else's style. You got, you know, a little too much Steinbeck, a little too much Hemingway, and when it's best, and it really rings through, and it's true with music, and it's definitely true with writing, is when your own voice, your natural voice, and what's coming straight from your heart comes out on the page. And I think that's one of the hardest lessons to learn when you begin writing. You know, who did you get saddled with as a young writer, as a drunk writer? Who were people telling you sounded too much like, or who did you think you sounded too much like?
The one that the Moses books echoes the most, and I hear this from people, they say like they can see, is Crumley. James Crumley was just like the guy to me. And he didn't write enough books because he wrote slow. So that's one of the reasons I started writing those books, is I went, fuck, there's not enough of his books. I'll write my own version of them. And I like those books, and I love them, and not enough people know Crumley to sort of see that, but part of me also isn't until a memoir did I actually discover what is my voice, like my clean, clear voice. It was in those Moses books, but I got it clean by the time I got to the memoir. It's like it took me some time to figure that out. What is my voice? What do I sound like when I write?
Is it something you can even really figure out, or is it something you just have to wait and keep on pushing and pushing till it just blossoms on its own? Is it something you can really, you know, this is my voice, or is it just something to count?
I believe it's honesty, and I really think that's true. I think that's all that a true voice is when you're brutally honest about what you feel and what you think words should look like and what a sentence should feel like. When you're brutally honest, nobody else has ever written a Josh Stallings novel. So that's my unique voice if I'm being honest. If I lie it all in there and try and do something cute that you'll like and think, oh, if I write this, Tom will think I'm cute. then it won't be my unique voice. It will be my unique voice channeled through what I think other people want. So for me, that's what true voice is. I discover it when I'm willing to just be brutally honest and not care what anyone thinks about it. Wow.
Yep.
Sorry, that was the cat. That was my cat.
Was that?
I'm sorry.
Our only caller for tonight.
There you go. In the production booth with me, what can I say? It just simply means people are listening, guys. Don't worry about no call. People are listening. It's too interesting.
You're good, Pam. You're good.
Thank you. Thank you. Pulled that one out real fast, didn't I?
All of our egos are really appeased now.
Thank you.
Fucking writers.
Hey, the show does it right. You've got to watch your book sales rocket. Just, you know, keep an eye on Amazon a few hours after the show. In fact, they may have already rocketed up and settled back down again. So you may have missed the actual bump.
I may have
no
missed
worries.
That little wave.
Right.
It moves
you're,
quick.
Your phone start pinging with all those sales, you'll know we're doing something right, hey?
I didn't know you could be pinged. I don't want to be, I don't want the ping on my phone for my sales because I feel like it might be more of a pong. But
if I chased that shit, I looked all the time. Like at my first year, I was always checking my numbers and what are the sales doing? What's this doing? And I realized it was making me into the worst fucking guy in the world. I was angry, and nothing was like, sorry, whatever it's going to do, it's going to do. Just walk the fuck away, Josh. You have no control over it.
For me, I kind of just lost interest in it. And it just seemed like, the periods where I checked in seemed longer and longer apart. And it really, you know, it doesn't. You know, it doesn't really change the outcome. I mean, you can, you know, you do your best and just kind of let it go. Having your eye on the ball and not really knowing what those crazy Amazon numbers what they really mean. You know, you sell book and it jumps up 20,000. It's a distraction and I think kind of unhealthy in a lot of ways. But I think that also goes to the individual. Steve, do you check your numbers a lot?
I did towards the beginning of Bad Citizen Corporation just because it was the first book I published. And, you know, I have a background in marketing. And so I was just trying to see, you know, what things were connected to things and what things moved the needle and what things didn't. But I am like you guys now where I'm checking less frequently than I was before, for sure.
Hey, can I ask a question? Josh, first, do you look at your reviews, speaking of Amazon?
Yes, I do. I look at them and I try and take it all with a grain of fucking salt.
You have to, don't you?
Because the problem is if you take the good ones seriously, you got to take the bad ones seriously, and I don't want to do that.
Right.
The best day I had, I'll be nominated for something, and that same day someone puts up a review that says, this should be in a landfill. It's that awful.
Right, so, right. What about you, Steve? Do you check your reviews?
I do, but less and less frequently. I was checking daily for quite a long time there in November and December. And I'm like Josh, you know, like I've come to the place where it feels to me like if I wrote a book that moved somebody one way or another to the point where they had to go post a review about it and I got a rise out of them, then, you know, that's something to be said there. But you do have to kind of take it with a grain of salt. Otherwise, you know, writers are all fragile beings, and so, you know, you can go down a spiral if you don't watch it.
Yeah. Tom, do you check your reviews?
I do. I haven't recently. That ADD, I peek at the you know, oh, there's still, I can't remember how many there was last time. There were 51. Oh, there's still 51, and I won't bother checking. And I do, and I think what Josh has said is very true. You've got to take them with a grain of salt, whether they're good or bad. Because on both ends of the scale, you've got, you know, you're like, what an awesome review. And it's, you know, your friend from high school that you asked to give a review or something. Or, you know,
right.
But if it's a complete stranger and it seems genuine. And those 3- and 4-star reviews are what I pay most attention to. Because that's what, when I go and check out somebody's book, when I'm thinking about reading a book, and I, you know, especially the big authors, I'll look for those sort of not 5-star reviews just to get some sort of middle ground opinion. And that's,
sure.
Yeah, those are the people that are taking it pretty seriously. But I've been blessed with pretty good reviews. I think if I was
if I had a lot of negative stuff in there, a lot of 1 and 2 stars. Of course, I've got some, but I probably would never look at the page. But I don't ever go back to pat myself on the back to encourage me to move on. But I need more of them. Hopefully, with the re-release of the book, maybe I'll get a few more, because I know that they do. I don't really understand how, but I know they do play into the algorithms of when your book pops up and you know, other customers looked at and that kind of thing. So I know it's very important, especially with the Amazon thing.
The
but
numbers
mostly, I just
are.
Wish,
yes.
I wish we could break out of the whole. I mean, Amazon, God bless them, because they've made me some money and they're there, and they've broken open a market that would otherwise be unavailable to us as authors. But I really wish it's a one horse town, and especially if you're with a small press, and you're just beholden to Amazon in so many ways. So,
the interesting thing is you're also beholden to Goodreads, since Amazon owns them. So, you know, where else do you go to look at reviews? So that's really a problem. But it is true that the algorithm does. I studied it for a week and had to bleach my eyeballs afterward. It's an amazing thing that. Yeah, it's just really, it's sad. I went to the people who wrote the algorithm the same way as I did for the people who wrote the algorithm for Facebook, which changes every 2 months. It's just going through its period again. You know, thank God that PMS thing is almost over. But, it's a hard thing. How did you feel, Steve? Did you ever get a one-star review?
If I have, I haven't seen it. I've been kind of waiting for it, so...
Okay, because you need to have your one-star cherry popped, because, you know, you're not an author until you get a one-star review. What about you, Josh?
Yeah, I just the worst reviews I've ever gotten were two that I got for Beautiful and Naked and Dead just recently, and one of them gave it a one-star and said it was crass, the language was bad, and I looked and thought, the title is Beautiful, Naked, and Dead. What the fuck did you expect?
Right? Exactly.
You picked
what
that
about
up,
you?
And you were upset that it was crass.
Right. Tom, what about you? Have you ever gotten a one-star review on any of your books? I can't imagine.
Yeah, I believe so, and definitely some two stars that sounded like one star. It's funny, because sometimes the ones with the least stars turn out to be pretty good reviews. You know, well, I liked it for this reason, it just had this problem. And you're like, well, you know, that's not too bad. And sometimes the 4-star reviews sound like a kick in the face. But my favorite are the kind that, like Josh says, like, I was really upset about the language. Do you really need to use those kind of words? And, you know, it's a story about junkie hustlers in San Francisco that, you know, are out there sucking dick for money in the street. And what did you expect? Exactly.
But my mother gave Tom 5 stars, by the way.
Oh, good Lord.
That is hysterical.
Josh brought his mother to a reading we did together, and I read a passage from Hustle that involved a rape scene.
Oh, I know what you're
talking about. Your mom's here.
I remember which one you read, because that's the one that you have on the YouTube, right?
Go ahead.
You did a Hustle. I know there's a video from Hustle that you did.
This particular passage was particularly disturbing, especially for somebody's mom.
Well,
and she wasn't
disturbed.
She said he was a nice fellow.
Well, he is
a nice fellow.
Josh, do you like doing Flash?
I've never been able to pull it off. I was asked to do it for a site once, and I wound up, there's 1,000 words, I wound up fiction. It was for Shock and Honey. And I turned in 1,300 words nonfiction, which he published, but I was like, I'm not real good at it.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
Steve, do you like Flash?
I love it. I after I wrote Bad Citizen Corporation and was trying to shop it around and find a place for it, I fell into the Flash a little bit. And Tom was actually one of the first people that posted me. I published twice without a gutter, and he's taken a couple of my stories. And I like it because I like that it's confined. You know, you can knock them out pretty quick and you can get them published. But they're also fun to read. I did a reading this weekend, and the woman gave me 15 minutes at this bookstore, which is awesome. But I was like, no one wants to hear me read for 15 minutes. I much rather read a really impactful 2 or 3 minute piece of Flash fiction and then kind of move on.
Sure.
Well, not only Steve was instrumental in breaking out of the envelope over Flash Fiction Offensive. He sent in stories and then turned around and had an actual audio version with backing music. So we had like the complete package where people could click the link and listen to it read by a professional while they read the story, and it was a great immersive experience for the Flash Fiction Offensive. Never done before or since. So congratulations on that, Stephen. Thank you. Feel free to send more.
I'm turning it back over to you, Tom, for you to wrap. And thanks, guys, for letting me ask some questions.
Absolutely.
Thank you both for being on. I'm going to drop your names and books one more time. Steve S. W. Lawton, his book, Bad Citizen Corporation, is out now. And Josh Stallings, Young American, along with his Young Americans, his Disco Heist novel, is a great fun read. They're both great fun reads. They move fast. They're light. They're gripping. And you get sucked in, and they're just everything you want from a book. It's what reading's supposed to be about. And thank you very much. And I want to say next month, February 17th, James Lee Burke, the man, the legend. We're going to break it down, and we're going to see if we can make him blush. Thank you, Pam, once again. And we'll
talk
to you next
guys.
Month.
Everybody have a great evening.
Thanks
for being with us.
Thanks, guys.
Good night.
All right. Bye-bye.